I know it's old news at this point, but I was in a store yesterday and I saw the Timothée Chalamet Vogue cover in person, and I truly, like, I went and jumped back, and that was crazy. I also got to inspect it, like, really up close, you know, the physical object, and I was like, yeah, it's bad.
It is a crazy note to end on for Miss Anna Wintour.
No, this is Chloe Mel's cover.
No, this is Anna's last cover.
What? Wait, I'm so confused. I thought that the whole thing was that this is Chloe Mel's.
I think that that's what people assumed, but it's actually Anna Wintour's last cover that she's, like, oversaw.
Because it's Annie Leibovitz, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that would explain why it's Annie Leibovitz, because I can't imagine Chloe Mel, like, working with Annie Leibovitz immediately when I feel like that's Anna Wintour's girl. That's her beat.
One thing I appreciated about it is that it brings me back to that image of Timothée Chalamet in the galaxy pants on a red carpet for, like, yeah, it's like the Nymphomaniac premiere.
Because we've talked about that on this very podcast, and maybe that's what the reference is.
I certainly doubt it, but to me, that's what the place I go to, so at least I appreciate that.
It was an internal callback. I like Annie Leibovitz, you know, she's done her thing. I do think she's a little overused, but her penchant for, like, gray saturation is really fascinating to me, like, derogatory. The coloring on Timothy is so bad. Like, it looks like it's like the wash on a piece of film or, like, filmmaking before you color grade it. Like, that's what it looks like. It looks like the first draft of an image.
It looks like it hasn't really been adequately edited. And then, like, also, like, she has sort of a history of really not knowing how to photograph people with, like, darker skin tones, because I don't know, her, like, neglect of
well, it's kind of that, but also she does just actually make everyone look gray. It's just, like, a widespread making people look gray thing that just, like, obviously doesn't work for everybody, but I don't know if it's necessarily, like, not knowing and more like an active choice to make everyone look gray. Like, she likes, yeah, this desaturation.
It's giving Tim Burton.
Yes, which worked really well for her during that Tim Burton era of, like, Alice in Wonderland and, yeah, stuff. It's really bad, but I kind of just appreciate it for how gauche it is. Like, I am a little bit like, okay, Vogue has gone low culture.
Maybe this is a conspiracy planned out to make Chloe Mel seem really a good choice as her successor. They're like, we're gonna really leave it on a weird note so anything she does will seem like an improvement.
I just can't imagine Anna Wintour taking part in any of, like, okay, when I first saw it, I was kind of like, did Anna Wintour kind of, like, guide, when I thought it was Chloe, like, Mel's cover, it? I was like, did she get sabotaged? Which would be really funny.
LOL. It's also, like, you know, Timmy's, like, only the third man to ever be on a solo cover of Vogue. It's just, like, all around, like, a pretty wild decision. But also it kind of feels perfect for Timothée Chalamet as he is in this current moment, which is, like, annoying, random, and just sort of hard to pin down.
Yeah, like, erratic.
Like, I'm really, like, I find him a little insufferable at the moment. I don't really like this whole, like, legitimize me as an actor phase, because I think he's really acting erratic in order for people to take him seriously. Like, I think he's trying to pull, like, a classic Hollywood stunt. I don't know. It's like, just be a theater kid. But what is this weird, like, performance art type of shit that you keep trying to pull? Just, like, be a theater kid. That's fine.
Yeah.
Like, you're doing great.
Did you see the Marty Supreme? It's like this PR stunt where they, like, it's like A24's YouTube channel released a Zoom call between Timmy and, like, the Marty Supreme team.
Yeah.
Where he's being, like, really insufferable bro kind of vibes. And then it's, like, this PR stunt. And the video is named Marty Supreme, I don't know, like, back-end call or, like, logistics call or something. I don't know. They're really trying to do that, like, go back to that original A24 marketing, ex machina type shit. But I'm like, oh, it all feels, like, really exhausting to me. And the Marty Supreme, like, Supreme hoodies, have you seen that?
I've seen, like, jackets? Like, the merch and stuff. Yeah. I think also the fact that it's, like, a Safdie. Is it Josh or Benny Safdie?
Oh, God. I think Benny just did the Smashing Machines. I'm assuming it's, okay, Josh.
When I think of the Safdie brothers and I think about, like, both Good Time and Uncut Gems and sort of the kind of cool guy slash film bro vibe that kind of went with the marketing and like everything around that. Like, it's not just that you're into, you're a film boy. It's like, I don't know how to describe it. There's like a type of guy. I remember Pete Davidson wearing a t-shirt of Robert Pattinson's face from Good Time on like a late night show and like being really annoying about it. And I'm like, yeah, that also lines up with like all this Timothée Chalamet bullshit. And I'm like, oh my God.
It feels like a dilution of the brand. Like, stop, to me. Stop.
I think only a man's career would benefit from him acting more insane.
Totally. Well, yeah, because we have the whole male genius type shit and like the male actor method, like same exactly. as Austin Butler did not get really many hits on his brand for being the most annoying person in the world after Elvis, although Ana de Armas also didn't for Blonde, and like I'm having trouble forgiving her, but also I mean, no, both movies are pretty bad, but yeah, in other news, Zohran met Trump. We know this is delayed news, but like truly one of the most fascinating things that's ever happened.
How do you be Zohran Mamdani right now? Like, how do you go, I just like sat there in front of cameras and called the president of the United States a fascist, and he
even then Trump was like, purr, bitch, yes.
Yeah. Trump is like in love with him. Trump has such a big crush. I'm like, I want to meet Zohran. I want to feel this magnetism that he clearly has. Like, that must be a rizzed up guy. And like, he already is, obviously, on the screen. But like, in person, I'm like, what the hell?
It is fascinating because like Trump and Bernie during that like original election, like during those parallel primaries that were happening, like both of them had this kind of rogue spirit, like somewhat anti-establishment, like coming in from the side, coming in from left field, you know? And Zohran also has that. It's just the other end of the spectrum. But it is like, I think Trump values this kind of like rogue energy.
1,000%. It makes sense. And I think what they were really getting to is the fact that there is a section of his base that voted for Zohran. Like, there are MAGA for Mamdani guys. Some of their Instagram accounts come up on my feed for some reason. Like, those are people. And I think it's because at the end of the day, what's becoming like more and more clear is that people are concerned about affordability. These are both candidates that like ran on platforms concerned with affordability before they like were really about being a part of a political establishment, like that trumping everything else. It just makes a lot of sense. And I also think like we're going to see like a lot more like left-wing uses of populism in like upcoming elections,
Less like disingenuous, but yes, like not actually inherently because I feel like populism is kind of somewhat inherently,
but
like
just,
but yeah,
but
no.
Like use what I mean is like using the language of populism,
the people,
like
the people.
Using a lot of the approach,
yeah. Well, because everything's about class politics, and we've been distracted by this fucking stupid culture war, and it's like that's not actually real, and class politics are, and that's the way forward. Not that Trump ever actually like adhere to any of those class,
but he convinced a lot of people that he would.
But he convinced
them. I first, when I just saw like, oh, he met Trump, and like it was just a picture of him smiling like or whatever, like standing next to Trump, I was like, oh God, how does this guy survive this? Like, what is this gonna do? Like, and then when I actually saw the content of what went down, I was like, fuck, he did it again.
Also, he kind of looked like a little grandmother in that, but he just looked like little grandma, like sitting in her little chair and her like grandson's visiting her. Like, that was the energy between the two of them.
I mean, like, also, you know, Trump is like that is a senile man, I'm pretty certain. So like, also his response to Zohran is like, it's not even that baffling. I'm like, yeah, you met like this charming young guy and you talked about New York. Of course you're delighted.
He's like yes, dear. Yes, dear. Fascism? Well, yes. Anyways, crazy, perplexing. God, catch us 10 years ago saying any of this. Like, the timeline's so crazy that we're like, that was actually extra crazy because no one's perplexed by anything anymore. But that was truly perplexing and fascinating.
Yeah.
And yeah. Well, Mr. President's going to be coming up quite a bit in this episode. And speaking of, I'm Aiyah.
And I'm Hannah.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is about communication on the internet. Online, we may have shot the shit, but have we also shot the messenger? If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps us out a lot. Hannah just dissociated into oblivion during that. McBeal, one of the most iconic shows of the 90s, follows a high-flying Boston lawyer named Allie as she navigates the balance of her perfect career and less-than-perfect love life. It was also a show known for its mumblecore dialogue and the integration of less-than-perfect computer graphic imagery whenever they wanted to express how Allie was feeling at any given moment. So it shouldn't have come as a shock then, in one episode from 1997, when Allie is dithering about her biological clock and hallucinates a pixelated dancing baby in her living room, who dances to the tune of Hooked on a Feeling. You know, the one that's like, hooga chaka, hooga chaka, that one. The whole arc is that Allie is at first befuddled by the baby, but then eventually, as she comes to accept her clock, decides to dance along with it to, like, a Lilith Fair-style rendition of the song, because, like, of course. Except it was a shock, because the baby is fucking horrifying. It's, like, transparent and gray and pixelated and has eyes that don't move, and was actually the brainchild of a software company called Autodesk, who created it as a sample file for customers who wanted to know more about Autodesk's animation plugins. Its creators made it kind of blank for the purpose of allowing people to alter it the way they wanted to. And it worked because the baby became a superstar in the chainmail and chatroom circuits. See Hannah's episodes about those respective things. And eventually crawled out of the digital realm and made its way onto Allie McBeal, to everyone's chagrin. And while it's hard to say for sure, it's likely that the dancing baby was the first internet meme.
Whoa.
Hannah, care to illuminate our listeners with a definition of what a meme is?
It's something that is repeated and sort of like remixed and perpetuated in this context online as it gets like shared along, and there's like new variations added to it and such.
That was great, Mama. Perpetuation, remixing, it's all there. You hit on a lot of things. Allow me to get more specific. So the word meme was coined by an evolutionary biologist named Richard Dawkins in his 1976 book, The Selfish Gene. The word meme can be traced to the French word for same or the Greek word for mimoumai. But in this book, Dawkins is looking for a word to describe a unit of cultural transmission. So likely it was derived from the word phoneme, which means the smallest unit of sound in speech. There's this amazing book from 1999 by the scholar named Susan Blackmore called The Meme Machine, where she kind of elaborates on Dawkins' point by saying that a major distinguishing factor of human beings is our ability to imitate. Like, from babyhood, we're imitating our parents, right? They'll be like, peekaboo, and you're like, peekaboo, or whatever. And she says that when we imitate someone, that thing we're imitating gets passed on to other people. And this can be endless. It's kind of similar to what we're seeing in our chainmail episode with folklore. Like, folklore can sometimes be a somewhat longer version of a meme. You can think about it like that. But it can also be a tune or a catchphrase, fashion trends, ceremonies, games, anything that's sort of like a transmission of knowledge or behavior between people that can transmit basically forever. But Hannah, based on what we've discussed, what do you think is the key difference between chainmail and memes, or like folklore and memes?
Like the image aspect of it?
No, because I think chainmail could just be an image that you send in. Like,
I guess
forever.
To me, like, a meme is a kind of folklore. Is the remix part, is it?
Yes.
It's the customizable element of the meme.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, the meme is viral, but it's also importantly, like the baby, malleable. Like, the most important feature of it is that it mutates and morphs. So when we think of the internet meme specifically, these are memes, kind of like visual earworms almost, that can be altered again and again and again and again, both visually but also in their meaning. You know, so like if you have, let's say someone tweets something, someone could quote tweet it and literally just put, you know, I-, you know, like when people are like, I, and that completely changes the meaning of the original thing that they're sharing, you know, like it can be that small. So they're extremely powerful, and I like this quote by this guy, Andrew Price, from memes.com, who described them as, quote, an idea that rips through the public consciousness. Hannah just made such an impressed face.
Well, I was like, it's true that.
So the meme format, as we know it now, is pretty classic. Usually it's a picture associated with some sort of caption, both of which can be altered to change context. This format was actually traced back to as early as the 1920s from this British periodical, where it's like two cartoons. So like on one side is like a sexy dandy guy on the left with the caption, "How you think you look when a flashlight is taken." And then a way less detailed, kind of like sillier drawing of a man on the right with the caption, "How you really look, ha." It's from this like 1921 edition of a satirical magazine from Iowa University called The Judge. And they would actually like regularly publish these like expectations versus reality images. So it is considered the earliest known version of the internet meme format because it was done with like regularity, essentially. But do you want to take a guess where the meme originated on the internet?
Well, would it be chat rooms? Like, where else?
Okay.
Predating that or post?
No, weirdly, like, in its current format, no, not predating that, no. It is, like, pretty hard to say exactly where this current meme format began. But, like, research was pointing to the idea that basically it really morphed into its current form on 4chan. 4chan is kind of the perfect birthplace for the meme when you think about it, because it follows the super Darwinian interface where people are competing for engagement. You know, so if your post is engaged with a lot, then it goes to the top of the feed. And if it isn't, then it falls into obscurity at the bottom. So like you want to be making stuff that's going to get up there. You want to make stuff that's like going to resonate with people, be relatable, etc. So memes in the form of like image macros, so, you know, that captioned image, were really useful for quickly grabbing people's attention on the site and condensing a point into like a visual soundbite, like a visual earworm. Do you remember some of these really early image macro formats, like early memes?
I feel like the earlier memes that I can think of are probably like actually in like the lineage of memes a bit later, but I'm thinking like condescending Willy Wonka,
yeah,
like Bad Luck Brian, that baby who's kind of going, yeah.
I don't remember that one.
You know, it's like a baby and he's like this.
Kind of.
There's also the drunk baby one. And then there's like, I guess like lolcats.
Yes, exactly.
Those, I mean, Rickroll, that was a meme.
Yes.
Yeah, those are the main ones that like, that are coming to mind from like that early days of the meme.
No, and that's exactly what I'm thinking of. Yeah, immediately what came to mind was like Bad Luck Brian.
And those horrible stick figures.
Oh yeah.
Do you remember there was an ESA meme page and it was like so stupid?
There was a meme page for McGill too that I thought was actually pretty good and funny. I love following the ones that are like, and we'll get into this, but like I love following the ones that are about like your specific environment. Like Montreal meme pages I loved back in the day. Toronto ones, like there are these guys who run a podcast called Cold Pod. Hi, Cold Pod in Toronto. And I feel like they kind of blew up also for making like really specific memes about Toronto culture in a way that felt.
Yeah.
It was like, ha, like really speaking to what I know. Yeah. So Bad Luck Brian, like these. So that's a bit later. But like Bad Luck Brian, also the little girl like side eyeing with the fire in the background. I feel like that was one of them.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
There's also somewhat more recent ones, but like distracted boyfriend. Expanding brain, like the galaxy brain ones, or like the they don't know party meme. We like that one.
Oh yeah. Drake hotline bling.
Oh, Drake hotline bling, like yes, no, yeah. So yeah, usually it'll be these like very eye-grabbing images with like the older ones kind of had like white impact font on them, and originally they were supposed to be super relatable, ideally. There was like a Cinderella meme too. There was like kind of like girl meme.
Yeah, there
pages.
Was the most interesting man in the world one where it's like, yeah. I don't always blah blah, but when I blah blah, I blah blah.
Yeah, there's like a m'lady one. Very simple. Feels like early internet, simple days, you know, har har, viral video of like cat throwing up, that type shit.
Totally.
I think the public is dying to know, Hannah. What's your favorite meme?
Right now, my favorite meme, or not right now, I think my favorite meme is the meme that I probably like quote in my head the most, which is, it's a girl, I think it's a photo from Facebook, and it's a girl with a bag of chips on top of her head. She's in like a convenience store, and the caption just says, I love her, she's so crazy. It's so silly, but I like think it all the time. I'll be like, I love her, she's so crazy. Like, that's probably the one I quote the most.
She does say this a lot. It really had a deep impact on Hannah as a person. Hannah does love, it really speaks to you as a person though, because I feel like you do surround yourself with somewhat insane people, like, and girls, like insane women, and you love to, yeah, be like, my friend.
Well, like when your friend does something where you're like, I love her, she's so crazy.
No, well, I don't know. Yeah, well, precisely.
it's usually used sarcastically, right? It's like, that's the whole point, is that this woman is not really doing anything well, that crazy. Like, she's got a bag of chip on her head. Yeah, but if, like, someone online posted something that they think is, like, them being super epic or, like, random or awkward, it's, like, then you respond with that. But I don't know. That one I think is endearing. I like Go Piss Girl. That's probably the other one I say the most because it's just fun to tell people to go piss girl. And I feel like those are my main ones. Yeah.
No, those are good ones. They have had a gorilla grip on the culture for sure. Mine are a little bit more like random core. Like, I really just like a really bizarre image. I love her.
She's so crazy.
No, I know. Precisely. And bitch, I'm one of the crazies that you're friends with. But I love like one that's kind of like an image I simply could never explain. And then a really strange caption beside it. So one of my favorites is, it's like funny because it is just like actually just a screenshot of like something from like, I think it's like an antique show, but essentially it's I'm pulling it up because I just want to explain it. It's basically this picture of this like somewhat cockeyed doll with like a snaggle tooth and like a little bonnet, and it's quite terrifying looking. And I think it's from some sort of like auction show or antique show. And the caption under it on the show says, "Oi, mister, you me dad's doll, $40 to $70. And I guess someone just had to like name this doll, and that's what they named her. And it really does. It just spoke to me on such a spiritual level when I saw it. Like, it lives inside my mind.
It is Maya's favorite. Although, what is the customizable element of that? Like, what do you apply when Mr. Yumi Dad to?
I don't really fully know how people have customized it, but it has like traveled the interverses, like the internet. Like, I feel like it's used as almost like a response to things. Like, I've seen people post it as like a response. Yeah, these are like less easily customizable, I guess, or like they're not
really, more esoteric.
They're definitely esoteric, but they have traveled. I think the customizable thing is that they're used to kind of like respond in different contexts to things. I think that's what's customizable. So you don't customize the actual image, but you're customizing like its usage and like what it means when you're whatever
the context.
This one is a picture of like, it's like a baddie, like extremely chesty woman computer graphic on the phone, but with Jimmy Neutron's head. And
oh yes,
the caption is, "The authorities have been notified, love." And I guess it's from a video game, but then Jimmy Neutron's head is on it, and I don't know, I can't explain, like, it really, again, the visual earworm thing, but those memes have just, they're living there. Like, they will not go away.
For all the many years I've known Maya, like, way Mr. Yumi Dad has been, like, very present. Like, I didn't actually need her to answer this question. I already knew that was her favorite meme. Like, it's, like, very much, like, a fundamental part of her being.
To be honest, I just had the idea that I'm going to dress up as her for Halloween next year, because that feels, like, integral to my being.
No, you need to be in the same city as me, and we need to be Shelley Duvall and Sissy Spacek.
We can't talk about this again, Hannah. I think we've talked about Halloween in like every episode this season.
I know. But like, I'm just saying it out there so the people know. Maya and I are going to be in the same country for Halloween. Our hair is going to be perfect for this costume.
We'll see about that. That's really beautiful.
Hey!
I'm just kidding. I just really want to be Snaggletooth Doll. But I also want to be...
Oh, I missed you. Can do two costumes.
I keep forgetting this isn't a bonus episode, so I'm being kind of like extra loose and annoying right now, and I need to refine myself.
It in for the public, please.
I also follow a lot of like cynical meme and like shit posting accounts. Like, I don't know, I follow like On a Downward Spiral, which is like this meme account that's, I don't know, it has like 40 admins. I really like following, speaking of like environment or like location specific, but I love Nolita Dirtbag, which is just like a New York specific. It's like an account that makes fun of like guys in Soho, basically.
We have a London equivalent. One's called Sock House Meeting.
Oh, I've seen that one.
Yeah. And then the other is Real Housewives of Clapton.
I followed that for a bit. Yeah. But then I was like,
yeah,
I just can't relate. Yeah.
But well, sometimes I'm like, okay, like I'm like, it feels good to get it where I'm like, I kind of get that. But then sometimes I'm like, you are really just like taking a bunch of commodity goods and like putting them on here and being like, isn't this a type of person? It's like tabby girlfriend, gray sweater boyfriend, name of trendy bar, name of trendy cafe, my vibes right now. And I'm like, what is this? Is this a comment on something? Is this a critique of something? Is this supposed to be funny? I think you're just observing things that are trendy.
No, I completely agree. And like, I interviewed my friend for this essay, and she was talking about how she like had recently read a supposedly fun thing I'll never do again by David Foster Wallace, which I am now reading, where she was like, I realized that like I am so layered in irony. And she was like, so I ended up having to like unfollow all these like niche meme accounts because it just like they come for everyone in a way that's like, okay, well then everything is cringe and you can't like, nothing feels safe or sacred anymore. You can't just like be yourself. Nothing feels original. And like nothing is original, but I just don't need to be made aware of it, I guess.
Yeah, that's actually what triggered me to do the exact same thing. I used to follow a lot of really niche ones back when I was in my early 20s, and then I unfollowed them because I was like, God, this is just so fucking negative and like so judgmental, but like for no reason, and over stuff that's innocuous. It's like, it's fine to critique things that we like see as like trends, but to a certain extent it just becomes acknowledging things. You're like literally just pointing stuff out, and like it's not clever. These are just observations, but you're not building on them. You're just like, people wear that right now. People go to that place and people watch this show. And sometimes those are the same people. Isn't that a crazy type of person? It's like, no.
Well, one I really like is, now it's called Doomscroll Forever, but it used to be called like Northwest MCM, like wholesale memes or whatever. It was run by this guy named Herman. I think he's from like Seattle or something, but it's kind of him crashing out about like gentrification, but in like the funniest way possible, where he's just like really roasting like matcha wearers, but he really is crashing out. Like he's like, he'll make memes about like his recent breakup in the funniest way possible. Like I don't know, it feels like doing that but with like almost a, like a subtle political angle, but using irony to kind of get that through, which we will talk about. So hold okay. on a second,
I'm putting a pin in it.
Put a pin in it. There's also Joan of Arc, our girl. It's kind of like esoteric, like very simple stripped down memes. Sometimes it's just like a photo of Lana Del Rey and like a caption, like general caption. It's like kind of girl meme.
I kind of miss the era of meme where you were just like, look at this picture of this person doing something and like just writing something above it, where it's just like, let me use this person's face as like a placeholder for an emotional reaction and then like write something. Yeah. I feel like I don't see that as much anymore.
What, like Bad Luck Brian?
Yeah, I'm like, bring back Brian.
Bring back Brian. Okay, I need to get it together. This is a real episode.
Someone needs to reel her in.
Guys, this is what you'd be missing, though, if you're not on our Patreon. So, like, I don't know if you're enticed. I don't know if you're allured, but, like...
Don't you want to get your money's worth?
Get like, your money's worth, mama. You want to hear me talking baby talk?
The holidays are coming up. Just saying.
Yes. You could hear me talking baby talk and Hannah having health anxiety, and that's kind of like our...
Hey, I won't do that too much on the pod, although you guys missed a riveting encounter with a spider on our last bonus episode.
It was horrible. It was horrible, bro. It kind of feels like you also just like bad-eyed me with that, because then the next day I found like the largest cockroach known to humankind in my house, and it was truly horrible, and I felt like you kind of sent a curse my way.
Bitch, you live in New York City.
I know, they're everywhere.
You cursed yourself.
Cursed my damn self. All right. So I feel like anytime we talk about some sort of evolution on the internet, it always starts with this whole, you know, everything felt so liberating back then type beat.
This show is so nostalgic from stupid shit.
And this is kind of no different. In its early days, there was kind of like a utopian and transformative character to the meme, or the way at least the meme was understood. It was considered like what you could call like an open work, this kind of authorless art where ideas could be transmitted freely and super fast. This is this really great dialogue from Art News about the meme and Dadaism, where they say that the meme is, quote, related to the utopian thinking of some members of the early 20th century avant-garde that there would be a progressive death of the author as the artist's hand and individual voice became less important. So it's this thing with like unlimited collective potential, and like the best part is most people can make a meme because, you know, all you really need is Microsoft Paint to do that. So it just feels like very accessible, very open, everyone's coming together to make something that kind of has like, it kind of is just for pleasure, you know?
It's like you're like making each other laugh.
Guys, the holidays are just around the corner. Personally, I like to get my shopping done early. The only problem is I'm always holding out for the perfect gift, which isn't always easy to find. Luckily for me and my loved ones, Quince has me covered. With Quince, you can find luxurious gifts like cashmere sweaters or Italian wool jackets for super reasonable prices. Hannah told me she's never felt fancier than when she puts on her new Mongolian cashmere sweater from Quince, and she loves to see the shock on people's faces when she tells them it was only $50. Plus, her fingers are going to stay nice and toasty all winter long thanks to her beautiful shearling gloves. And if you thought Quince was only looking out for the fashion girlies, you thought wrong. Quince has gifting options for everyone in your life, from the home cooks to the world travelers. I, for one, have been cooking up a storm in my stainless steel sauté pan, which I bought after having a freak out about nonstick, but that's a story for another time. Find gifts so good you'll want to keep them with Quince. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash. Being moody doesn't have to be a bad thing. Sometimes it can be fun to lean into how we're feeling by surrounding ourselves with things that match that feeling. Our moods play a big role in our choice of music, food, even lighting. So why not extend that logic to cannabis products? This is possible thanks to our sponsor, Mood, an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC products right to your door. Gummies that only get you high? That's so passé. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. And with our promo code REHASH, you can get 20% off your first order at mood.com. Whether that's mind magic gummies for deep work and creativity, sleepy time to get you settled for a restful night, or chill out for some needed relaxation. THC gummies are everywhere these days, so why not go with a brand that lets you customize your experience? Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. The best part is, Mood ships directly and discreetly to your door. That means no more waiting in dispensary lines, and no risk of an awkward run-in with your mom's friend Mary. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code REHASH. So head to mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code REHASH when you check out to save 20% off your first order. And over the 2010s, it started to expand beyond that typical, like, relatable or observational content and actually into more niche forms, kind of like the meme pages that we were just describing. Do you remember Goth Shakira?
See, that's someone that I unfollowed because I was like, girl, your vibes are, like, too negative.
Wait, sorry. Elaborate.
Well, no, it was just like, okay, mind you, this is a pre-Barbie movie, pre-Little Women Greta Gerwig. She literally put out Lady Bird. And then she made this, I think it was her, and if it's not her, I do apologize, but I swear it was her, and it was like, this is also right after, like, Hillary Clinton, I think, lost the election, which obviously, like, don't love Hillary Clinton, but it was, like, a weird time where people were, like, obviously it still sucked that Donald Trump got elected that first time. And she just, like, posted this meme that was, like, I bet Hillary Clinton thinks that Greta Gerwig is so girl boss. And again, Greta Gerwig had just put out Lady Bird.
To be fair, she did fully predict that, though.
Sure. But I'm just saying, like, in the moment, I was just like, okay, I don't know, there was something about, like, following these, like, feminist meme pages where I was like, okay, but you're also, like, cynical and, like, I don't know. I was just like, I just felt like there's something about irony culture that was, like, really getting to me at that point, because I was like, this is, like, I've always felt a little bit adverse to, like, irony or, like, heavy doses of irony. I'm a very earnest person, probably too earnest. And I can take a joke. I can take sarcasm. But I was just like, it kind of felt like it was making it impossible to enjoy stuff and then, like, making fun of people for politicizing things, but then also politicizing it at the same time by linking those things together. And it just kind of felt like this empty critique where it was like, yeah, there's, like, mainstream feminism is flawed and, like, but I don't know. It just felt like she was projecting bullshit. Sorry, this is, I don't know this woman. And maybe it wasn't her.
There was a time where if you came for Greta, you're done with Hannah.
It wasn't just the Greta aspect of it, though. It was just like, this is a feminist meme page. But also, like, if women enjoy things that, like, they consider feminist or something, or, like, enjoy or appreciate, like, the work of other women, that's also kind of lame because someone's selling you that woman. And it was like she'd made one movie for A24.
Yeah, I could see that more post-Barbie, but definitely not pre-Barbie. Come on.
Well, this is, like, what I'm saying. It's also, like, this is pre sort of, like, TikTok, everyone being overly precious about things made for women and, like, women artists. This was just, like, this period where I was, like, I feel like women artists weren't getting any attention or due, and it just felt really lame to me to just go for it. And the name of being like a cool girl or something. Sorry. I don't know Goth Shakira.
Girl, it came from the heart and that's all that matters, you know.
Thank you.
I was not expecting this beef between you and Goth Shakira, but this is really interesting.
And then if it wasn't Goth Shakira, if it was a different meme page, I'm really sorry.
You're shooting blindly. No. Well, it's interesting what you say about irony here, because like we'll talk about what she has to say about that. So basically, Goth Shakira was this girl living in Montreal at the same time that I was living there. And basically, she's this like Latina woman at the time she was in her 20s who made these like hyper specific memes. Like they'd usually feature Latina celebrities like Selena Gomez or Jennifer Lopez making weird facial expressions. And then they'd have these like really long esoteric captions that usually had like a feminist edge to them and usually sprinkled in some astrology too. They were just very like late 2010s type shit. Hannah, can you describe and read this one?
So it's an image of J-Lo kind of smirking and looking to the side. And the caption says, when he says, haha, my ex-girlfriend was crazy. And you know, you must automatically translate that to, haha, my ex-girlfriend was coerced into playing an emotional game in which I allowed my own insecurities and fear of commitment dictate how I treated her, meaning that I led her to mistrust me by playing hot and cold with her affections, or worse, causing her to respond in a way that might otherwise be deemed irrational as a crisis-induced tactic of emotional self-preservation.
Yeah, they definitely like not have punctuation.
But I remembered these. It's all coming back to me now.
Very long form, very specifically kind of like art ho neurotic girl, educated. Like they would reference like scholars a lot.
Yeah, so I loved R.I.P. Anna Nicole Smith, who like was always just like very referencing similar academic work, and then became like best friends with Suki Waterhouse for a minute, which was really random.
Well, yeah, so this is funny because like basically Goth Shakira blew up and she'd do these like gallery shows in Montreal displaying her memes as art. She's a columnist at the LA Times now, which is pretty sick. Whoa. Kind of like astrology columnist. I don't fully know, but yes. Yeah, she got interviewed a lot at the time because people were starting to be like, you know, can memes be art? And she has this quote where she says, quote, back in the day when people went to consume vaudeville shows, it's entertainment. Theoretically, it's not supposed to be profound. It's not like you're reading Moby Dick or going to the opera. What's fascinating to me about memes and what I've tried to do when I produce them is turn that on its head by taking a format that people don't think is going to be meaningful and using it to say meaningful things. So again, there was a lot of hope placed onto the meme at this point as being this ephemeral object that could spread information at warp speed. And there are many accounts that have been born out of the Goth Shakira type meme admins. Like, you know, there's again Joan of Arca, who's doing these really high concept like minimalist memes. There was this one called Big Dog Socialism or something. I couldn't find it when I went back for it, but it's a Canadian account that makes like lefty political memes. Doom Scroll Forever. There was also this like whole group of meme accounts that ended in selectuals. I don't know if you ever saw these. I think the original one was like in selectuals, and then there'd be like all different types of like branches of that were also like high concept like shitpost accounts. But yeah, so I'd say like in the 2010s, we see a sort of intellectual elevation of the meme from like, haha, man face, silly, to like, this is art, you know? And there's a lot of scholarship on the idea of irony of this wave of memes as acting as a sort of like Trojan horse for important political ideas, because there's that sort of distance and humor attached to it that can be kind of disarming on top of the viral aspect as well. Kind of like what I'm saying about Doomscroll with like the gentrification critiques shrouded in irony.
Yeah.
And I think Goth Shakira is a pretty like obvious example of that, and one of the earlier ones. Does it always land? Certainly not, as evidenced with Hannah and Greta Gerwig.
Well, I was just like, it's not a political cause to think that something that lots of women like is dumb.
No, and not to be so annoying, but there's like an episode of The Office. Me referencing Friends in The Office, like, oh God. But there's an episode of The Office where Oscar's like, they're watching some crazy event happen. I think it's some sort of police chase, and then Oscar's like, he kind of critiques it, and then Kevin's like, believe in something, man, like that literally. That feels like this, you know, believe
well,
in something.
Well, that's what that kind of era felt like. It was like really uncool to earnestly care about something or to get behind something, and I mean, not that I think we've actually fully gotten out of that era.
Definitely not.
Perhaps it's gotten worse. But I just remember at that time, it felt like it was more like those in the know to like not be so earnest or something. Or it was just like felt like a very cool thing to sort of be critical of things in like this really blanket way, which I just think is boring.
I think we're still in that, but Dasha just, you know, she just got dropped by her agent. So apparently everyone's like, woke is back, you know? So we'll see.
Yeah, we will see. We will see.
Though now I'd say we've reached the late stage of this kind of meme where these admins are now doing like bespoke branded meme content for like North Face. Or like this one I follow just did one about like, it was like a partnership with Square. The post was like critiquing again like the people who get their matchas and wear their whatever fucking Gorp core. But then it was partnering with Square. Like, it was really confusing.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing, is the ones that, like, are critiquing certain kinds of consumerism are then obviously making money by doing brand partnerships. And I'm like, you're not actually critics of consumerism. You are consumers, and you just want to point out that you know about things.
Well, a lot of the time is Spider-Man meme. It's like, you are a creative director, and so is everyone else. But I can't talk. I simply can't join this conversation because I kind of do the same thing, but
no, you're just have to make money. Not the same thing.
Thank you so much. But yeah, it is kind of crazy seeing a meme and you're like, oh, this is just a meme, and then you like go down to the caption and you're like, oh no, it is not a meme, it is an ad.
I refuse to engage with comedy content online that's like branded. I'm like, honestly, obviously get your bag, whatever, I don't care, but also I'm like, this isn't funny because it's not coming from the heart.
I will lend credence to the concept of memes being art, though, because that shit is actually so hard to do, and you do have to have a specific skill set to be able to do it. Hannah and I, like, we've tried to make memes for our Instagram page, which, you know, most podcasts have, and we can't. Like,
no.
That part of my brain is not functioning, so I do admire people who can do
like
it.
That.
We're not fucking funny like that. Well, I think we're funny in our own special, unique way.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Let us know if we're funny. So that's the liberatory side of memes. But going back to Dawkins and the origins of the meme, why do you think that his book was called The Selfish Gene? Why selfish?
Because the strongest one is the one that, like, continues to perpetuate.
Yeah, like, essentially. Like, yes, I think it's a facet of it, for sure. There are critiques to be made about Dawkins' theory, but yeah, it is kind of like evolutionary biology. Basically, like, Blackmore says that one of the key qualities of a meme is that it's going to spread around indiscriminately, regardless of whether or not it's useful, neutral, or negative. Dawkins' whole idea is that genes are going to, like you're saying, perpetuate, like propagate onto the next generation, whether or not they're harmful. So, like, think about my mom passing down her early graying hair gene to me. You know, I don't deserve that, but here I am with this. Or, like, you know, worse genes, like someone being predisposed for dangerous illnesses. And so Blackmore says that, of course, memes don't care about where they go because, like genes, they're selfish. The whole point is that they have to keep moving and mutating like a really powerful virus, which kind of changes the whole conception of the meme being inherently benign or even positive. Sometimes it's actually quite malignant. It's really cool and all that everyone is the author of the meme, but like every other episode, we're going to talk about why this whole idea of like democratic on the internet kind of fucking blows, actually. And I think we really see that play out in the story of Pepe. Let me tell you the story of Pepe. Most of the information I got from this is from this really amazing documentary called Feels Good Man from 2020, which you should all go watch after this or before it. It all started with Matt Fury, who's this soft-spoken little cutie who back in the day worked inside the toy department of a San Francisco thrift store and spent his time there drawing comics. In real life, like growing up, he'd always been drawing frogs, but Pepe the Frog came to be on Microsoft Paint as part of like a lo-fi illustrated series called Boys Club that he created, which is all about like the hijinks of these different anthropomorphic characters, mostly based on Fury's own life experiences with his own roommates. And, you know, it's full of like fart jokes and whatever, masculine humor. He'd post some of these comics online, and basically Pepe took off when bodybuilders, probably what we'll now call gym cells, took this one frame from one of the comics where Pepe is peeing with his pants fully down and like the bathroom door open, and is basically explaining to his friend who's like, his friend's like, ew, and Pepe's like, It feels good, man. They made this into an image macro, and it started circulating and being placed on image boards and made its way onto 4chan, where Pepe was redrawn with like a sad expression on his face and became this symbol for like incels or loners as a kind of like reclamation of their own weirdness and loserdom. They interview this incel in it, and he describes it in the documentary as finally being okay with checking out and living in your mom's basement and being like, yes, I'm proud to be like a loser who lives in my mom's basement. So Pepe was kind of like at this point, like the sad Keanu or Ben Affleck memes used to evoke sadness or melancholy. A lot of people on 4chan didn't know who Pepe was created by, and quickly it got so popular that it spread off of 4chan and into more mainstream channels. So then it got taken up by normies, which in this case, normie is just a shorthand for women, and became this like makeup tutorial trend where girls would like paint their faces to look like Pepe. And so basically in retaliation, the guys on 4chan started this thing that they called the Beta Uprising, where they declared like World War III on normies and began to make Pepe memes like super violent and offensive as possible to shake people off of them. So it would be like Pepe as the hijacker during 9/11, or like Hitler Pepe, or whatever. The most incendiary shit you can think of. They also started putting him in images with like Elliot Rodger, who we remember is the incel who went on a shooting spree back in 2014 and murdered a bunch of people, who then became an icon among the black pill incels. So by the time 2016 came around, Pepe was redrawn again from a sad face to a smug face, kind of like a more ironic self-aware expression, always placed into this offensive imagery. And the documentary explains that Donald Trump was the personification of this iteration of Pepe, this new smug iteration, because he was like a real life troll and because he speaks in like sound bites, right? Because of this, the people on 4chan take a liking to him because he felt like he was rogue and misunderstood during his campaign trail, kind of like a provocative outsider. So they start deliberately making memes of Trump to counteract the liberals because it makes them feel like they're kind of a part of this insurgency or rebel group. You know, this guy's coming from the outside within, like we talked about at the beginning of the episode. So just, I don't know, imagine like a bunch of lonely, disaffected losers finally feeling like they have power, right? Trump eats it all up and ends up retweeting a meme of himself as smug Pepe. And this is basically what won him the disenfranchised male vote. Like he really, like he was at that point winning over these like younger men who would turn to MAGA in a way that like the establishment Republicans weren't. Pepe ends up getting added to the Anti-Defamation League's list of hate symbols. So basically becoming like an internet swastika. And Matt Fury is obviously fucking horrified. He's like, genuinely this sweet little guy who just wants to make children's books, and now one of his characters is like a hate symbol and his name is also on the Anti-Defamation website page for it. So the movie is basically about his efforts to win Pepe back as a symbol for peace. But Pepe was so far gone at this point, so Fury's efforts feel super futile. And this is really a crisis of authorship, right? Because ultimately, Fury can't fully lay claim to the image now that it's been transformed, right? It's been mutated and it's spread as much as it has. At one point, he even tries to kill Pepe diegetically within the comics and have all the roommates like attend his funeral. And I was curious, Hannah, like, do you think it's possible for a meme to die?
No. Because once you've created it and you've decided to share it and like put it into that ecosystem and make it available to the masses, like, you don't own that anymore. Like, that's the whole point. It's open source. It's, like, democratized. Unfortunately, like, it's not something you can exert control over. That's why no one knows who created memes. That's it's not something that, like, gets attached to it. It's not yours to keep. And unfortunately, that's, like, the risk that you run. I guess it's more difficult because Pepe emerged from something else, like it emerged from his own like kind of artistic work,
but they kind of all emerged from something else, right? Like Bad Luck Brian is just some guy's photo day photo, right?
But in this context, is he the one that started perpetuating him like as more of a meme, or was it like he was creating? So like in that case, like that's horrible and that sucks for him because it's not like he was like the one who decided to turn Pepe into a meme. But when you put imagery onto the internet, it's really, really hard to lay any ownership over it.
It's hard, and I was racking my brain as to like, is it possible at all for a meme to just go away? And I do think it's nearly impossible for a meme to truly die, and like kind of is just impossible. I think the only way for it to kind of go away is becoming obsolete. like losing cachet. Those early Image macros, for example, like they're not really around anymore. They're not circulating the same way. They kind of exist in like the Internet Archive more than anything. But we probably will reach a point where they become cool again, you know, and
oh, for sure.
they'll come back. And so it's hard to say. But I do think that's the only way for it to go away.
Think about Taylor Armstrong from Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, who she became a meme. It's like woman yelling at cat. It's her distressed. People who watch The Real Housewives don't realize that that is a clip from her yelling with these women who are confronting her over like their suspicions that her husband is physically abusive to her.
Which he was, and then later committed suicide.
Yes, and it's from the darkest chapter of this woman's life. But I've listened to interviews with her where she's like, you know, obviously the context of this is horrible, but like you can't control being a meme. Like you kind of just have to embrace it. Like what else are you going to do? You as the person who's been memeified, it's beyond your control. And I guess like it's the same when it's your artistic output. Like people are going to take from things what they're going to take from things. But whatever like sick individual who did watch The Real Housewives took that screen grab and decided to make it a meme, bird in hell. But like, you know, people who perpetuate it, it's like they don't know. It's like it's an image. It's like becomes this open source thing.
Do you think memes generate violence, or does real world violence get absorbed into memes? Like what comes first, I guess? What affects the other?
I'm like always really skeptical about the idea of blaming any media product for human behavior, because it tends to usually be human-made atrocities that we'd like decide to blame the media for. Like of course it becomes a scapegoat, and like not only that, but obviously memes are really powerful modes of communication, but at the same time not powerful enough to like convince someone who wasn't going to like commit an act of violence to then commit that act of violence. Perhaps the memes are more of an artifact from like an internet culture that is having an effect on an impressionable human being, and it's coming out of like certain rhetoric and it's part of something bigger. But no, I don't think that a meme itself could induce violence.
Interesting. Well, to me, it's kind of hard to tell, and it isn't definite, obviously. Obviously, yeah, we don't want to get into like the, oh, Marilyn Manson is what gave way to Columbine or anything. But I do think they can be powerful. So during Trump's campaign, Pepe started being called Keck, which became this almost like spiritual white supremacist movement that attempted to make Hillary Clinton collapse in public. And they believed they succeeded when she actually eventually did. In the documentary, they interview this occultist who talks about this concept of meme magic, which is essentially the idea that within these like complex digital networks, the meme can become so powerful, used by so many people, having little distinct point of origin and moving so, so quickly that it can impact the real world. And there was a lot of talk during this meme war era that these Pepe memes are what put Donald Trump, the guy who originally like no one took seriously, in office. Obviously, we know there were like a ton of factors at play to get him in there. Also, you know, one being that the Electoral College is rigged and that he didn't actually get in there in the first place. But it's hard to deny that sheer momentum of his face and like sound bites online, combined with this more youth culture slang and imagery like Pepe, were very much working in his favor. So I don't necessarily think that like the image itself has a direct correlation towards violence, but I think the sheer ubiquity of an image and the fervor around it can incite people to do, like, I think what Pepe did was like embolden a disenfranchised group that was prone to violence to actually like move towards something. So I don't think it's the actual image, but I do think the power of like the ubiquity of something, I don't think we can like ignore it almost.
I think that also there's something to be said about humor being used as a desensitization tactic, whereas especially the kind of humor that's often evoked with memes, it's cold, it's detached, it's ironic, and so it presents serious things with this sort of covering of not taking it seriously, but like once you've been exposed to that enough, I don't know, I think it has a kind of a weird effect on how you relate to that subject matter.
Well, there is a power of like a mediated gaze, like seeing the world filtered through social media, filtered through, like meme culture, filtered through video games, for example, you know, like.
And Right. And I think, like, I always have complicated feelings about, like, even some of the, like, debates around, like, video games or, like, mm-hmm. movies and, like, how they influence people. Obviously, I don't think that they're helpful. Like, I don't think... I think some shooter-based video games obviously have not had, like, positive effects on people who might be otherwise... who might already be inclined to that kind of behavior. I think memes function in a different way where they just present these things as jokes to the point where maybe someone doesn't necessarily... Well, someone as in, like, a being who is vulnerable and, like, maybe susceptible to something like this, a certain type of person might then continue to sort of not take this concept seriously to the extent that maybe they act out. But again, I just think that it's, like, it's a factor. It speaks to a culture. It speaks to, like, chat rooms where people are probably making other jokes about this, you know?
No, totally. There's something to be said also about memes being, like, a language, like, being some sort of fluency of, like, imagery. It's image-based language.
Sure.
And I think that can also be quite powerful. Like, if you're speaking through the image,
when you think about, like, propaganda techniques,
exactly.
and the importance of, like, imagery there, I mean, it makes sense. I think if you, like, pre-internet memes, propaganda is often, like, used as examples of that.
You have to ask how much tech companies are playing a role here too. Like, 4chan is a pretty ad hoc platform, but Pepe was circulating like crazy on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as well at the time. And there's this essay from this book called Post Memes: Seizing the Memes of Production, LOL, where the authors are like, underneath the apparently free-floating world of circulating texts, images, memes, there is an asymmetry of information. The means to produce data is decentralized to us, but the means to collect and process that data is re-centralized to the proprietors of the platform-based services we use. And I was talking to a friend recently who brought up this really good point. He was like, why was the Charlie Kirk video able to circulate and stay up the way it did? Like, how did it bypass community guidelines when, like, the outline of a nipple can get taken down almost immediately? And his whole conspiracy, like, theory was that he thinks the big tech companies kept it up on purpose. Like, they wanted that to spread. What do you make of that?
I feel like people have pointed out in the past how somehow, like, violent imagery is less censored than female nudity because we live in a fucked up culture. Also, I'm not entirely sure about what the current state of the community guidelines are for a lot of these tech companies, because they were really, like, playing fast and loose with that shit around Trump's second election, or, like, around the 2024
well, with
election.
X and all the, like, neo-Nazis there.
Yeah, and Facebook, too, though. Like, Mark Zuckerberg
well,
is
a total cuck
for
Trump. Well, that's, like, more historical, for sure.
Yeah, so... I don't know, kids manage to see all sorts of crazy shit. It doesn't surprise me, I guess, is what I'm saying. And I guess, like, perhaps maybe there's also the argument that, like, that video is news. Like, that is a piece of news. It's not necessarily, like, the same as snuff, like a snuff film being passed around. Or I don't think it's regarded as the same as that.
A snuff film being passed around would not be as advantageous for people as, like, a Charlie... Like, they're benefiting from the discord that that video creates. Like, even though the video inherently goes against what their alleged community guidelines are,
but then what
they're
about
benefiting
with, like, BLM,
from that discord.
Like, think about all the videos that, like, were passed around and perpetuated during BLM and, like, shared.
I'm not making a political argument. I'm making more of, like, a malignancy argument.
They're benefiting from the traffic, so they're keeping it up.
They're benefiting
in that
from
sense.
The traffic and the malignancy of it and the discord. Mm-hmm. And, like, the, you know what I mean? Like, I just think that the tech companies do also have a hand at play in the way that this stuff spreads and proliferates, I guess, and multiplies. And, you know, it's a cancer. It's, like, kind of like a cancer.
Oh, of course. No, of course. That's why they don't want to have harsher guidelines for this type of shit. Like, we all know that the most engaged with content is the content that, like, makes people angry or impassioned. Also, what's crazy, I haven't seen the Charlie Kirk video. I've, like, really avoided it.
Oh, I haven't seen it either.
Oh, see, that surprises me. I feel like you're someone who's, like, seen so much more gruesome imagery than I have. You have, like, a morbid curiosity for it.
I've seen it. I've also accidentally stumbled upon it. Like, once again, the first viral video I saw on the internet was Saddam Hussein getting executed. But that was before the days of, like, harsher community guidelines. I saw Tupac's autopsy photo when I was a kid.
See, that would have, like, psychologically damaged me if I saw that as a kid. It has
psychologically damaged me. Right, you know that's why you are this way. Yeah. Anyways, sorry, we got a little bit off topic, but speaking of malignancy, there's this great essay in Spike by Travis Deal that's about J.D. Vance's head. Have you seen the J.D. Vance meme? It's kind of one of my favorites, unfortunately.
I actually don't know if I have. Can you send me?
Yeah, just look up J.D. Vance meme.
J.D. Vance meme. Ugh. Oh, it looks so creepy. It's not the bald one.
Well, there's many iterations, but I think the original is more like he has it's like he has kind of like an
blue
afro
background, right?
Yeah, like he, and he's kind of like smiling, and yeah.
That is horrendous.
It's really scary. So the J.D. Vance meme is very simple. It's basically just an enlargening of J.D. Vance's head. Like, it just looks like kind of like a puffier version of it. And sometimes it has like an afro and kind of looks like a m'lady guy. Like, that's the whole point of it, with like super piercing, like beady eyes. It took off around the time that Trump won and it became super ubiquitous. And people started being like, does this mean that the left can meme after all? Because remember that whole like fuck ass discourse about which side of the political spectrum made better memes and.
Oh, yeah. Like, who's funnier?
Yeah, and people were like, oh, this is clearly lampooning J.D. Vance. But basically, the J.D. Vance head is kind of like a counterpoint to the Pepe meme, and more of like a
This you'd kill a Victorian orphan.
God. And more of a reflection of where we're at now in the stage of meme making. Pepe became this sort of like targeted, intentional meme that was meant to generate discord and like rile people up, or literally like impact the outcome of elections. But this essay is basically talking about how there's no real distinct political affiliation to the J.D. Vance head. Deal is arguing that actually the meme just as easily could have been made by conservatives. Like, we might assume that it's supposed to be an insult, but based on the language and logic of those image board sites, it also could have been like playful joshing or like lovingly poking fun. He says that originally back in 2016, Trump and Elon's kind of like tacky antics were considered tacky and undignified. Like, there was a sort of level of outrage around them, but now they've become the norm.
Remember, people thought they, like, got Trump by, like, pointing out Covfefe? Like, people milked the fuck out of Covfefe. They thought they were so clever. It's like,
yeah.
Covfefe wouldn't have even, like, made the news this time around. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's also that there's kind of, like, a cringe element to older generations being really, like, obsessed with Trump being so whack and so weird. Like, they're very, like, focused. Whereas younger people are very much like, oh, he's kind of funny. Like, that's the era we've entered into, even if you don't like him.
The J.D. Vance meme kind of feels like Poot Lovato vibes.
It's a little Poot Lovato. And, like, yeah, the J.D. Vance head kind of is the symbol of that normalcy. Like,
I don't know the intentions of the person who made Poot Lovato. Do they like Demi Lovato? Do they not? It doesn't really matter.
It's almost funny. Feels like a return to, like, manhead funny, you know?
Yeah.
So Deal goes, this was not the end of the head. I love this article. It had completed its transformation into a sublime hyper-object, interpolated with the universe. The energy of the head had returned as a mimetic residue to the online culture that spawned it. Had it been a protest, a tribute, a coup? It had been everything. The head of J.D. Vance reveling in its mutant will to power. In the aftermath of the head's explosive growth, even the head's enemies had to concede that the head had emerged unscathed. On the contrary, its agnostic features made it strong. So it feels like in the years since 2016, the meme has almost returned to this like neutral, maybe chaotic neutral force, as opposed to like an overtly malignant one. Like, it's still selfish. The J.D. Vance head is like populating everyone's feeds and mutating constantly. But it's almost like it's apolitical in nature, or agnostic, as Deal puts it. It's like we've reached this stage of like shitposting where the meme can't be liberatory. It can't even be like explicitly malignant, because both of those things are cringe. And so instead, it just means nothing at all.
I also think that perhaps there is something about the nature of the meme that I don't think it was ever going to be liberatory. I think it is way more set up to be malignant. I think it is way more set up to cause harm, because like ultimately at the core of a meme is making fun of something. I think that perhaps like snark is way more productive as like a means of making people act negatively than it is as like a means of inspiring positive action, for people to like do better, because people who make snark coming from like a place of good intentions are usually people who are going to cap what they do. They're like, that's my effect, which like I don't necessarily think people are gonna rally around a meme. I guess
it kind of comes to a state of nature discussion at this point, because it's like, you know, perhaps do we think human beings are predisposed towards selfishness and greed and evil? Are they predisposed towards being good and wanting to help each other?
Is the meme the test for that?
A little bit. Like, it just feels a little bit like it's such a blank canvas, and it's so fast and so communal that it kind of does start to represent the human condition in a way. You know, if we're really getting down to the basics of it.
You just got so galaxy brain memed.
Fuck. Also, anyways, like, you know, memes can kind of suck. And shout out to our friend Max, who basically got memed on World Star Hip Hop like 10 years ago for looking like Tyga, but like a white guy. So Max is now the white Tyga meme. And we have to say he's so much more than that. And so shout out to Max, the patient zero of getting fucking rocked by the internet meme.
I love her. She's so crazy.